Camacho ordered one of his accomplices, Larry Merrill, to cut the telephone line at the back of the house. No one would be able to call for help. In Dallas, USA, a family is torn apart by a nightmare. The father is lost and tries to escape, while his wife and child are kidnapped by a drug dealer. FBI agents race against time to find the hostages and their captors. The trail that leads them to Gino Camacho is littered with bodies. In the spring of 1988, drug dealers had infiltrated the population of the working-class neighborhood of Dallas. Subsequently, there was a significant increase in thefts and break-ins. Some families decided to leave the area for Pleasant Grove, a more peaceful neighborhood. Sam W., his wife Evelyn Banks, and their three-year-old son Andre took refuge on one of its streets lined with houses in Vera Ronda. Here, the neighborhood residents protected themselves among themselves. On the morning of May 20, 1988, a gunshot suddenly rang out in the silence. To the astonishment of a neighbor, four armed men emerged from the W house, dragging the family with them. Sam Wright managed to free himself and flee. The neighbor who had witnessed the incident immediately alerted the police. In the meantime, Wright was hiding behind the houses. Unfortunately, when the police arrived, the gang had already disappeared with Evely and little Andre in the car. Sergeant Jerry King of the Dallas Police Department was a detective at the time. He was the one who responded to the call. When we arrived, we saw the two-story house. As we walked to the door, we noticed that there were burglar bars around the entrance. The lock had been removed from the door itself. Strangely enough, detectives still hadn't heard from W. The mystery deepened even further when officers entered the house. Mahmoud. A murder had been committed. The body of a young man lay face down in a pool of blood. He could be identified by his driver's license. It was David Wilburn, 25 years old. Judging by the wound to the back of his neck, Wilburn had been killed at close range. Bullet fragments were collected during the victim's autopsy, but officers did not find the firearm at the scene. Investigators worked with minutiae and collected every promising piece of evidence. Unfortunately, there were few. They also began searching for fingerprints, but they all came from family members. Outside the house, officers discovered that the phone line had been cut. The crime scene yielded no leads to the kidnappers or where they had taken their victims. They had left nothing behind during this undisclosed raid. Detectives questioned the neighbor who had alerted the emergency services, hoping she would provide some answers to their questions. Apparently, Wilburn, the young man found dead at the scene, was Sam Wright's nephew. She did not know why he had been executed.
Through questioning witnesses, we learned that a white Continental shelf had parked in front of the house.
Four men had gotten out and walked toward the house. One of them went to the back, apparently to cut the telephone cord and watch the back door. Detectives also learned that the Latino man who was driving the vehicle had visited Sam on numerous occasions. However, no one knew his accomplices. Several questions remained unanswered. Where was Sam Wright? And why hadn't he alerted the police about the kidnapping of his wife and child? One thing was certain. A young mother and a 3-year-old boy were in the hands of a murderer. Since there was no time to waste, the Dallas police called the FBI. Special Agent Rosé Figueroa was assigned to the investigation.
Investigations surrounding a kidnapping are always treated as a priority, especially when a child is involved. We don't wait 24 hours to take action.
Figueroa began by trying to find Sam Wright, the man who had escaped the gang. He discovered that Wright had been wanted for 3 years in connection with a drug deal. This explained why he had disappeared without asking for police help. But the FBI agents needed him to move the investigation forward and help his wife and son. R might be hiding in the neighborhood. The agents combed the streets of Pleasant Grove and questioned neighbors.
We literally flooded the area with business cards and interviewed every resident. They were asked to tell Sam Wright to call the FBI office.
As hoped, a Dick card from Figueroa ended up in Wright's hands. His panicked father risked incarceration by calling the FBI. He asked to speak to the only person who could help him, Agent Rosé Figueroa. TB worked with Rosé in the FBI's Major Crimes Unit in Dallas. Sam told Rosé that he only knew the man who had committed this murder by his first name, Gino. He also knew that he had been arrested a few months earlier by the Mesquite Police Department for a murder in the Rio Grande Valley. Sam W. refused to go to the FBI office, but promised to call again. The agents now had a lead. We went to the Mesquite Police Department and met with Captain Larry Sprague. Larry knew exactly who we were talking about, that it was a certain Gino Camacho. Gino Camacho, 33. Was a known drug dealer who brought in shipments of marijuana that were then distributed under the protection of a small group of gangsters. It was also known that he had a girlfriend named Wanda Jackson. On Sunday, May 22, days after the kidnapping, agents tracked down Wanda Jackson. They asked her where Gino Camacho was. She said she didn't know. She hadn't seen him in a few weeks. The agents had a feeling she was lying. If the FBI had gotten their hands on Wet, perhaps they could have convinced Wanda to act as a go-between and made Camacho believe that Wet was willing to pay a ransom in exchange for the hostages. But the agents lacked any convincing arguments that would have prompted them to cooperate. They had to find W. The next day when he called, the agents were ready to trace his call. Okay. An agency team was already in the city center, ready to arrest him. The location of the payphone had been found, and the information was relayed to the team in place. When the agents found Wright, he was talking on the phone. They didn't take action right away. It was essential to avoid a violent response from W and his accomplices. Once they realized that Wright was accompanied by only the driver of the car, they took action. Bellevue was arrested and taken into custody. Agents Belly and Figueroa began questioning him. He recounted in detail the events of May 20th, 1988. It was a father's worst nightmare. That day, he was playing with his son, Andre. His wife, Evelyn, was sitting alone on the ground floor. The family was in mourning. Bubby's mother had recently died in Louisiana. He was waiting for his nephew, David Wern, and then had to drive to the funeral. Watched for W. Byrne to let him in. He was a fugitive. So he had burglar bars installed around the entrance, thinking they would protect them from both the police and his violent associates. But the bars were no match for Gino Cabo's wrath. Without warning, the four men burst into the house armed with automatic rifles. Samrick's past had caught up with him. The one who called him Gino began screaming and demanding the money he was owed. Swearing he didn't have it, he asked him to spare them. Gino's anger only worsened. At that moment, Wiyuta's nephew, David Weburn, arrived. He couldn't have arrived at a worse time. Despite his imposing stature, Gino's men quickly subdued him. We described his nephew as a quiet man who wouldn't hurt a fly. Gino yelled that he wasn't kidding. To prove his point, he placed the barrel of his .357 caliber revolver against Bobby Byrne's neck. A second later, with a single shot, he killed him. Helpless, W watched his nephew collapse to the ground. Sam W. wanted to cooperate with the police, but swore he had no further information.
No.
He was held in custody, but time was running out and the lives of his wife and child were still in danger. Dallas police and the FBI mounted a media campaign to try to find leads in the disappearance of Evil and Andre Banks, and newspapers and television stations broadcast photos of Camacho. Authorities asked the public to come forward with any information on the suspect's whereabouts. Another drug dealer soon came forward. David Mown called the FBI. Agent Bailey answered. Munoz said he recognized the kidnapper's face from watching the news on TV. They had information that could be useful to them. He asked Belly to meet him at a Dallas hotel late that night. Munoz said he knew Camacho's accomplices. He was even prepared to turn Camacho over to the FBI on unorthodox terms. Munoz hoped to recover the money owed to Camacho, take his place in all the deals he was doing, and he wanted us to turn a blind eye. We refused, flatly. Since he was the only lead, Bailey did not arrest him. FBI agents nevertheless managed to extract a key name from him, EDD Blaine Cummings. In the underworld, Cummings was known as Fast Heady. He had a criminal record. He had been incarcerated at the same time as Gino Camacho for illegal possession of weapons. Cummings was currently on parole. Special Agent Figueroa now had two names, Gino Camacho and Cummings. He made the rounds of nightclubs.
Camacho was the type of guy who hung out at the sex clubs in Dallas County. So we visited every bar in the area.
Figueroa had pictures of Camacho and Cummings. A bar owner recalled seeing the two men recently. Cummings had mentioned a meeting the next day at a restaurant in Lowton, Oklahoma, a 3-hour drive northwest of Dallas. A team of police officers gathered in the parking lot of the restaurant in question on the morning of August 12, 1988. The plan was to wait for Cummings to leave the busy restaurant and isolate him from the other patrons. The investigators couldn't miss him. Fast Eddie was the person they had closest to Camacho. As soon as the door opened, the arrest team sprang into action, arresting Cummings before he could flee. One of Camacho's accomplices was now in custody. The officers hoped he would help them find the young mother and child. During questioning, Sings swore he had nothing to do with the kidnapping. But Gorlis finally agreed to tell what he knew. For the first time, we learned exactly who was involved. He gave us the names of all the individuals who had participated in the kidnapping. Cummings confessed that Camacho was involved. He also gave the names of two other gang members, Juan Jackson and David Cook. He and Cook had grown up together in Stephenville, a 2-hour drive from Dallas. As far as he knew, Cook had returned to their hometown. Cook might be able to lead Bailey and Figueroa to Camacho, as well as Evelie and little Andre. The officers called Don Miller, a detective from Stephenville.
I called Dan Miller and told him we had a warrant for Cook's arrest for a kidnapping. I told him this was a very sensitive case and asked him to be discreet. The goal was for him to find Cook in Stephenville. Don told me he knew David Cook very well, had known him his whole life, and if he was in town, he would have no trouble finding him.
On August 15, 1988, Detective Don Miller called Officer Bailey again. Miller had found the suspect working at his family's grocery store. The detective agreed to hold him until the officers arrived. Miller had Miku in custody. If he knew anything, he had better cooperate with the FBI. The officers went to Stephenville immediately. They hoped David Cook would tell them where Camacho and his hostages were before it was too late. He agreed to help investigators on the condition that his sentence be reduced. After a 2-day interrogation, the FBI had a detailed account of the events of May 20. The day of the kidnapping, Camacho had picked up Cook and two other accomplices. He told them he planned to collect money owed to him. Camacho had given Sam Rocht $20,000 worth of marijuana to resell. Samard had told him that he had been robbed. Camacho swore he would get his money back. Rand Jackson opened a bag and distributed firearms to the group. Their arsenal included submachine guns and the .357 caliber pistol. Camacho ordered one of his accomplices, Larry Mary, to cut the telephone line at the back of the house. No one would be able to call for help. Rand Jackson cut the burglar-proof stockings while David Cook and Camacho were out to get him. They then burst into the house and found Evelie Banks in the living room. Camacho had his men search the house with guns drawn. The men gathered the terrified family in the living room. Camacho was furious. He threatened to kill them if he refused to cooperate.
Camacho told him to put the baby on the couch next to his mother and that if he moved or caused any trouble, he would kill him. Gino Camacho then screamed and demanded his money back. He said he had been cheated and that he was owed respect. He wanted his money back right away.
Through the screams, a knock could be heard at the door. The assailants initially thought that the neighbors had called the police. Camacho and Jackson got into position, ready to shoot the police officer. When David Wilburn entered, he was immediately surrounded by the gunmen. They pushed him to the ground without him putting up any resistance. Camacho ordered Jackson to kill him. When Jackson hesitated, Camacho turned to Cook. Seeing that Cook refused to comply, Camacho grabbed the gun from Cook and showed everyone that he meant business. No one would disrespect him in the future.
The interrogation Cook had undergone was intense. Despite everything, he did not contradict himself at any time, particularly regarding the fact that Camacho had fired the gun. These statements corroborated Sam Wright's. After leaving the house, Camacho was furious that W had managed to escape, but he decided not to pursue him. Soon, police officers would arrive in force in Pleasant Grove. Camacho decided instead to go to Cook's apartment, where he could then decide what to do. He wanted to make as few fuss as possible with his hostages. Paul Maclusaluso was the assistant district attorney. He was following the case closely.
They feared the consequences of their actions. Two witnesses had witnessed the murder, and they did not know what to do with them.
While they were in Cook's apartment, Camacho snatched the child from her mother's arms. He then dragged Evelyn into a bedroom where he raped her. Afterwards, he left the scene to take care of another drug deal. According to Cook, a new gang member, Spencer Stanley, was called in to guard the hostages while he and Camacho ran their drug deal at a nearby hotel. Ron Jackson did not stay at the scene for very long. He feared being arrested by the police. He cleaned the guns, took some of the gang's money, and disappeared. While Stanley watched the hostages, Cook and Camacho went to the hotel to close the deal. Then, days after the kidnapping, Camacho received a call from Wanda Jackson, his girlfriend. She gave him a coded message. Big Brother, of course, meant the FBI. Agents had gone to her house. This same girlfriend had sworn to the agents that she did not know where Camacho was. However, she called him immediately after meeting them. His warning gave Camacho and his gang a head start. He returned to Cook's apartment. He told Evelyn that he did not hold a grudge against her, but that her husband owed him money. He promised to release her and Andre if she swore not to tell the police. She agreed. Camacho then told her that he was going to drive her to a private airstrip in Oklahoma to fly to California. From there, she and the child would wait for Camacho to settle his differences with Watt. After a tough interrogation, Cuco told agents Kevlin and Andre that they had never flown to California. No plane was waiting for them. Cook remembered where their bodies had been left. They were near Oklahoma. In August 1988, special agents from the Dallas Major Crimes Unit arrested one of the gang members responsible for the kidnapping of a woman and her child and three murders.
Cook agreed to accompany agents Rose Figueroa and TB to Oklahoma. It was another step in the right direction. We were going to find the bodies of Evelyn and Andre Banks, and, most importantly, arrest Gino Camacho, their advisor.
We went to the Dallas County Jail.
We had permission to temporarily release David Cook from his cell.
I gave him a pair of jeans and a shirt in exchange for his prison uniform. We got into my car. Six or seven agents followed us. We drove off toward Oklahoma.
For days, FBI agents drove the roads around Hardmore while Cook tried to remember where he had last seen Camacho's hostages. According to Cook, Camacho had driven Evely and Andre Banks to a remote location in Oklahoma. The gang leader had promised the mother he would fly her and her child to California from an airstrip hidden behind the trees. They parked their car on the side of a road and headed into the woods. Spencer Stanley led the way, carrying little Andre with him. Evelyn thought she would be on the West Coast in a few hours, where she could wait for her husband to pay his debt to Camacho. But as Evelyn drove deeper into the woods, she realized there was no clearing where a plane could land. Then she saw the rocket engine, knew immediately what it meant. She lost consciousness. There was no landing strip and no chance of freedom. Evelyn and her son had been brought there with the sole purpose of killing them. Spencer Stanley threw the child into the gaping hole. Camacho fired four times. Then they threw Evelyn on top of her child's body and fired again. Evelyn Banks and her three-year-old child were killed on May 23, 1988. Cook was trying to find the location of the murders. The officers had almost given up hope when Cook finally recognized the area. The search for Camacho's victims began in the scorching heat of late summer. The kidnapping case had become a homicide case. Camacho had killed three people. But to prove it, the officers absolutely had to find the bodies. Three months had passed since the murders. The forensics began searching. They removed the earth in small quantities and sifted it, taking care not to destroy any evidence. Agents found .380 caliber shell casings just below the surface. This corroborated Cook's statement that Camacho had used a small semi-automatic pistol. They continued their work at a frustratingly slow pace. It must be remembered that we were at the very top. It was about 35 degrees Celsius and 90% humidity. We were surrounded by trees and therefore sheltered from the wind. We had no air and had to dig for about 2 hours. Then one of the experts threw a hard object. It seemed hollow. He gave it another blow and broke off a sort of crust. A foul odor escaped from the pit. It was the horrible smell of human decomposition. We jumped out of the hole and went into the bushes where we were overcome with nausea. Then we had to go back. Before burying Evelyn and Andre, Camacho and his men had covered their bodies with cat litter to hide the smell of decomposition. The clay in the litter had absorbed moisture from the bodies and formed a hard, airtight layer which slowed the rate of decomposition and would make autopsy easier. Cook then led the agents to Somme Lake, which was in the same area and where he believed the men had disposed of the murder weapon. A team of divers from the FBI's Oklahoma office explored the bottom of the lake. There were more .380 caliber shell casings. Finally, he found the gun. The evidence against Gino Camacho was overwhelming and corroborated the witnesses' statements. FBI agents hoped to charge Camacho with 2 counts of kidnapping and 3 counts of murder, but he was still at large. The agents learned that he had claimed another victim. This time, Camacho had turned his anger on a woman named Pamela Miller. The agents decided to investigate her. Pamela Miller was a stripper at a Dallas nightclub. She had met Camacho and started hanging out with his gang. According to Cook, he and Miller had met up with Camacho one night in June 1988. It had been only 3 weeks since Camacho had killed three people. He had risked returning to Dallas to make another drug deal, though. The buyer showed up at the hotel bar and began negotiations. Pamela interrupted the transaction.
Pamela Miller knew the buyer. He was a patron at the club where she was dancing. She told him she recognized him from seeing him at the club before. This caused some tension.
The buyer decided to leave and the deal fell through. Camacho was very angry with Pamela because she had caused him to miss this deal. As soon as they got into the car, he began to beat her. Pamela then made comments about Camacho's pseudo-manhood, and he became even angrier. Camacho's rage grew more and more. Cook and Stanley knew the consequences of this blind rage, but they were afraid to intervene. Camacho did not stop beating the young woman until she had lost consciousness. He ordered Cook to stop the car. He dragged the young woman's body onto the road, placed it behind the right rear tire, and ordered Koo to back up. Optera. They then went to Stevenell, to the apartment rented by David Cook. They took Pamela's body and put it in a barris, placed it on the paso, and put a garbage bag over it so that no one could see what was inside. Camacho, Stanley, and Cook stayed there for a few days. He drank beer and partied. Then Camacho decided it was time to get rid of the body.
We asked David where Pamela's body was. He told us we would never find it. When we asked why, he confessed that he had cut her up and put her in a wood chipper. I was driving the car at the time. Rosé was sitting next to me. We stayed there, speechless. I almost lost control of the wheel. I couldn't believe it.
When it came time to get rid of Miller's body, Camacho called an acquaintance in Dallas. He asked him to rent a wood chipper and take it to Stevenill. Camacho told him that he wanted to get rid of some trees so he could set up a clandestine airstrip. On Monday, the man arrived with the wood chipper. Camacho and his accomplices took an axe and the bar containing the corpse and drove to the Cook family ranch. Spencer Stanley cut up the young woman's body. The pieces had to be small enough to fit into the mouth of the machine. Cook led the agents to the ranch where they had torn the body to pieces. Finding any remains seemed impossible. Not only had the shredder turned the body to mush, but months had passed since the heinous murder. Furthermore, the Texas sunburn had probably accelerated the decomposition process. Still, the agents had to try to find something. Using the information provided by Cook, they assessed the range of the machine. They developed a grid system of the terrain and began to carefully comb the scene. The operation took a few hours, but was fruitful. The agents found bone fragments and human tissue. In a tree branch, there was also sun-dried human tissue. All the samples were bagged and labeled according to their location. The agents found teeth. A check of Pamela Miller's dental records confirmed that it was her. The discovery corroborated Cook's confession. Pamela Miller, 23, had been Camacho's fourth victim in as many weeks. But the killer was still at large, and a threat to anyone who crossed his path. The investigation then received a stroke of luck. The family members of Spencer Stanley, one of Camacho's accomplices, called the FBI. They told agents that Stanley was holed up in a trailer park in Huntsville, Alabama. Once there, detectives learned from Stanley that he had dumped the .357 caliber handgun Camacho had used to kill David Wyburn into the waters of Lake Hubbard near Dallas. An FBI dive team scoured the lake bed. The gun was nowhere to be found. But there was a .357 caliber shell casing and several blank cartridges. The projectiles connected to FAC Macho were sent to the Materials and Devices Division in Washington for neutron activation analysis. Agents hoped that the bullets found in Ray of Bird Lake matched the one that killed David Wyburn, Camacho's first victim. The analysis was based on the principle that the lead in the projectiles is produced in water, and that each batch has its own unique characteristics. FBI experts must first prepare the projectiles by removing them from the casings, then place them in a nuclear reactor. Samples of lead from each of the projectiles are placed in the reactor core. They absorb neutrons and become radioactive. This radioactivity is then measured and provides an accurate reading of the chemical elements in the lead. This is their radioactive signature. Analysts concluded that the signatures of all the bullets were exactly the same. The bullets in Lack and those recovered from Bulburn's body came from the same batch of ammunition. Evidence against Camacho continued to mount, even though authorities had yet to locate him. An informant told FBI agents that Camacho had fled to Mexico and was holed up in a small town just south of the Texas border. U.S. authorities tried to convince Mexico to have him arrested and extradited to the United States, but Mexican authorities were unable to intervene. The town where Camacho had taken refuge was controlled by heavily armed drug traffickers. If Mexican police tried to make an arrest, the losses would be too great. FBI agents had to find another way to bring this criminal to justice. By the spring of 1989, Camacho was in desperate need of funds. He knew many suppliers in Mexico. All he had to do was find a buyer north of the border in the United States. Since he was afraid of going back, he hired a middleman to find him American contacts. Camacho's middleman was actually an informant from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency. He called his boss and told him that a certain Gino wanted to make a deal.
Agent.
John Lant of the U.S. agency was working out of Fort Worth, Texas. He knew that Gino Camacho was wanted by the FBI. Since he suspected that it was the same man, he encouraged his informant to continue the process. Agent Bell of the FBI was then called to give him the good news. John thought it was Gino Camacho. I then sent him a photo of Camacho. He showed it to his informant, who confirmed that this was indeed the man who had met him. In order for Camacho to cross into the United States, the FBI made him an offer he couldn't refuse. The informant told Camacho that an American distributor was looking for $1 million worth of marijuana. The distributor, however, insisted on making the deal in person.
He was hesitant to deal with someone he had never met. To allay the trafficker's fears of entering the United States, the informant told him that the distributor was prepared to advance him $100,000 when they met in the frontier town of McAllen, Texas. Philip's scheme presented some challenges, however. The agents had to find a way to quickly identify the fugitive from other tourists crossing the border. To make Camacho easy to identify, the informant sent him some clothing under the pretense that it would allow the distributor to recognize him. The arresting team had to remember what he was wearing: a Hawaiian shirt, blue shorts, and a baseball cap with a green visor. Camacho received the clothes at a friend's apartment where he often went. The agents weren't convinced that a drug dealer from Camacho's background would fall for it so easily.
We only had one chance. If he realized it was a scam, the informant would no longer be of any use to us. Plus, he would be even more suspicious of undertaking a risky transaction. So we put together a very elaborate arrest plan.
On the day of the transaction, the agents set out to look for him at the border crossing. They hoped to identify him from the clothes the informant had sent him. The arrest team finally recognized him. Camacho didn't realize that the place was packed with agents disguised as security guards, tourists, and passersby. These agents had all memorized the suspect's clothes and photo. Camacho pretended to be a tourist. He crossed the bridge to Texas. FBI agents disguised as border guards approached him. The fugitive was calm. He gave a false name, Thomas Sanchez. When the agents asked him to show his papers, Camacho said he had none. He was just an American tourist returning from a day trip to Mexico. The agents asked him to follow them inside for questioning. Camacho agreed without resistance. He probably thought it was just a misunderstanding. He was unaware that he was already in FBI custody. Camacho was taken to the patrol office and fingerprinted. Belate waited for 2 hours in his cell. During this time, the agents checked his fingerprints. Camacho did not say a word.
I addressed him as Thomas Sanchez, and he answered. I told him that we had taken his fingerprints and entered them into the FBI system in Washington.
The computer confirmed that he was Gino Camacho.
He replied that if the computer said that, it must be true.
Camacho, however, was involved in the murders. To the end, he never claimed to have been involved in the kidnapping and murders. He claimed that he was the victim of a frame-up orchestrated by the FBI. The news of Gino Camacho's arrest made the front pages of every newspaper in the Southwest United States. From the border, he was taken to a Dallas County jail. He was charged with illegal possession of a weapon, conspiracy to kidnap, and first-degree murder. Camacho and his accomplices appeared in court. David Cook was sentenced to 24 years in prison for his participation in the murder and kidnapping. Spencer Stanley was sentenced to life in prison for the three murders in which he participated. Juan Jackson was also sentenced to life for his involvement. Tostay Cummings and Larry Mary were sentenced to 8 years each. Sam W. was sentenced to the prison term he had earned at the time and an additional year for violating the law. As for Camacho, state prosecutors hope to obtain the death penalty. Assistant District Attorney Paul Macaluso was working on the case. The prosecution's case focused on premeditation.
From the beginning, they knew why they were going to Oklahoma. It wasn't so that this little boy and his mother could fly to safety in California. Even before they set off, they knew they were going to kill them. They had bought shovels and cat litter to cover the bodies.
When they arrived at the motel in Hardmore, they sent Stanley to start digging the grave. There is no more tangible evidence, because a grave is dug for one reason only.
In Texas, to obtain a death sentence, it must be proven that there was premeditation and that the defendant poses a threat to society. For this reason, Camacho was first tried for the crime under state jurisdiction. Had the federal government trial taken place first, Camacho would have been incarcerated, thereby eliminating the threat he posed to society. In two trials, Gino Camacho was convicted of murder and kidnapping. The sentence was carried out 10 years after the deaths of David Wilburn, Andre and Devlin Banks, and Pamela Miller. On August 26, 1998, Gino Camacho was executed by injection.